the final takeoff was resolved at the 9,000 foot level, southwest approach of McKinley. I think the tape ran out. I'll briefly go over the leading episodes to the final takeoff. Originally, I mentioned the pickup was at about the 12,500 foot level below Windy Corner. We had been snowed in there from one day to the next with an 8-foot snowfall and tremendous violent winds. So, obviously we couldn't attempt to take off in this type of weather. We were lucky to retain the airplane. The airplane had been tied down to snowshoes, deeply buried in the snowbanks with ropes attached, and the snowfall partially covered the airplane. 8 feet fell in about 24 hours. So, and I mentioned again, the first takeoff was a success. We got into the air. The lower level of this box canyon we were in was completely shrouded at about the 10,000 foot level around the sharp turn of the canyon. Unable to outclimb it, unable to turn left or right, I must land straight ahead, which I did. The members of the other 16 of the expedition, and also Hans Moser's 8 or 9 man ski expedition, swiftly made way to see if we'd demolished the airplane, if we were injured, or exactly what happened, because they heard the sound, they heard the engine stop. They were not in a point of vantage to see what had happened. So anyway, we had help, and we built 3 consecutive fields clear down to the 9,000 foot level before it was possible to effect a takeoff. On the last attempt, all the emergency gear, the whole airplane, all of the personal gear of the injured climber, and all of the items possible to strip out of the aircraft were left at the 9,000 foot level, and takeoff was effected, and Dr. Lathrop's son was then headed for medical care in the great city of Anchorage. I might say that one of the world authorities on frostbite is Dr. Mills of Anchorage, bone surgeon, and he got a considerable amount of his frostbite experience from the expedition members and the climbers with frozen extremities, hands, feet, and faces that have climbed in the Mount McKinley area in the last 22 years. A fishing story, Talkeetna area. Throughout the summer, beginning from the 1st of June, tremendous runs of 5 different varieties of salmon journey from saltwater to the headwaters of the shallow gravel streams and the glacier streams in the Susitna Valley of Alaska to spawn. Following the salmon migrating to the headwaters are great numbers of game fish. The mighty rainbow trout and the sea run Dolly Varden trout, and the grayling, and in other areas such as the Yukon and the Kuskokwim and the interior rivers, often the sheafish and various other types of fish that are not native to the particular folks who sit in the valley. There are many excellent locations nearby. One such location is about 10 miles in the easterly northeast direction from Talkeetna. Now, the first of the run are the kings, tremendous salmon, sometimes go to the 60 to the 90 pound class, and they're the strongest swimmers of the salmon species, and they arrive in this area about the 15th of June. And they're, of course, followed by the other game fish that show up in profusion shortly thereafter. The red sockeye salmon and the silver salmon put in an appearance to the headwaters. They say, the biologists have estimated, the silver and the red sockeye salmon spawn in odd years, that is, such as 3, 5, 7, and such a cycle as that. It takes several years for the mature salmon to return from salt water. Originally, of course, the salmon was spawned in the shallows of inland freshwater streams and have returned to the salt water to mature. There are multiple runs of other varieties of salmon. And then late in the fall, as the ice begins to freeze over the open shallow streams, the peculiar thing happens. The shallow waters are vacated by the game fish. The salmon, of course, make a one-way trip into the areas of the shallows and spawn and die in the Alaska area, the Pacific salmon. Interesting feature is that the Atlantic salmon on the eastern seaboard spawn and return to salt water and live through several other cycles. Not so with Alaska Pacific salmon. They are born, or rather hatched, in the freshwater streams, return to salt water to mature, and return to the freshwater to spawn, and then that is their life cycle complete. Throughout the summer, great tonnages of various varieties of salmon come to this area and to many other areas of western Alaska and south and southeastern Alaska. And they bring with them the hordes of game fish, and of course the game fish attract the fishermen. And the trick is to find a place not inhabited by too many fishermen, and there, of course, the fishing should be fine. We often get the rainbow trout in the 6-7 pound class in this area. Bristol Bay area and the Illiamna Lake chain, and on over to the Wood Rivers and the Tiktiks, the Rainbow Trophy area of Alaska, they sometimes attain 12, 14 pounds, which is a tremendous, indeed, rainbow trout. I have many adventures in connection with fishing expeditions, being in the transportation end, flying float planes and operating river boats. You have occasion to compete with the swift rivers and the short shallow lakes in some cases, and take the fishing traffic to where the best locations are. On as I recall, about the 10th of October in about 1954, I had a crew of three Fairbanks fishermen in the Tunilna Clear Creek area, and the shore ice was running. The huge rainbows and the dollies in the 8 to 10 pound class were much in evidence as they were leaving the spawning shallows, and they were preparing to swim on down to the deeper waters of the freshwater and also to run into the ocean where they spent the rest of the winter until the following breakup. I had these three fishermen located on a very short sandbar, and as they fished from within several hundred feet of the landing location, they caught tremendous amounts of huge rainbow trout and fat Dolly Varden sea run trout. And as I recall, the day was quite overcast, and there was some snow falling, and the temperature was freezing in such a manner that as I wheeled the aircraft out of the hangar, took off, landed at Clear Creek to pick up a passenger, I was delayed 4 or 5 minutes on loading, picked up one fisherman and two gas boxes full of beautiful rainbow trout and some camping gear, and effected an immediate takeoff. But the takeoff wasn't soon enough because a large amount of snow had landed on the wing, adhered to the wing, and destroyed the lift of the aircraft upon takeoff. So this particular airplane was equipped with the dual tandem wheels. Main landing gear, that is, had two wheels, one in front of each other. And I came to the end of the sandbar. The usual procedure was to haul flaps on, and the aircraft would leap into the air, and you would be flying and gone and clear of the sandbar. So, in an usual manner, I hauled on the flaps. The plane staggered into the air about 50 feet, and it was apparent that I was in a stall condition, and I was going to land in the middle of the Talkeetna River, which is the main tributary, the parent river of the Clear Creek Tunilna. So, with the nose down, I gained some flying speed, and of course, full power all the way. And before I went into the Talkeetna River, I raised the nose a slight amount so that I wouldn't dive into the ice chunks head first with the aircraft. Anyway, the impact was flattened out enough to skip three times on the water and then up on a log-strewn bank on the left limit of the Talkeetna River. And I shut the engine down, got out to examine the damage, and I, to my horror, found that the tail section was bent up in the air about 30 degrees from its normal plane of flight. And with several axes, we busily cut down the obstructing trees and driftwood logs, and hastened to make a runway. With several straight spruce poles, we lashed to the tail and very carefully bent the 30 degrees tilt out of the whole tail assembly into a near level position as original. During this time, no more new fresh snow had fallen, and likewise frozen onto the wings. We did our best to clear the snow off from the wings, and I effected immediate takeoff empty and successfully negotiated the air with the lightly loaded aircraft, and landed in Talkeetna 6 minutes later, none the worse for wear. Picked the passengers up at a later date with airboat I had at the time. But whether it's a riverboat, a float plane, the hazard of motion must be competed with, and in order to negotiate some of the awkward locations of sandbars and rivers full of logs and rocks and lakes that are too small for a gross load to take off, you often run into very interesting combinations of loaded aircraft versus confined takeoff areas. During the springtime, usually from the beginning of the month of April, the big bears of this area stir in their dens and become hungry enough to wake up and break out of the den in search of food. Now, the area is inhabited also by huge moose, and the moose are fair game for the hungry brown and grizzly bears as they come out of hibernation. And on one particular bright April day, two clients appeared, and their intention was to get a colored movie coverage of any spring bear that we might find in the area. So we proceeded to the headwaters, the Talkeetna River, the Yellow Jacket area, and there we saw a huge silver-tipped grizzly in hot pursuit of a mature bull moose. The race took place down the side of a mountain, and the moose found a haven in some open water in the Yellow Jacket River. The open lead was about 75 feet long and 30 feet wide. So, for a matter of 15 minutes while we circled high overhead in bright, beautiful sunshine, the moose played tag with the bear. That is, the bear would go around and around the open lead, and finally, in desperation, the bear backed off 50 feet, made a tremendous run, and landed amidships of the moose in the water that was about 5 feet deep. Tremendous struggle followed, and in the matter, however, of about 2 minutes, the moose was the victim of the grizzly bear. Moose during this month of April are without horns, so their main defense is their front feet, and they're very vicious with their front feet, and they hit and stomp. The bear is loaded with offensive weapons, tremendous teeth and great claws, and a strength unbelievable. And in this particular case, the bear was knocked off from the moose, or fell off in the wrestling match that followed, and was trampled for a few seconds underneath the flailing hoofs of the moose. And very shortly thereafter, the bear, with his powerful front legs, got a hold of the moose's head and drug the moose's head down to water level, and promptly beheaded the moose like he had been eating a stick of celery. That is, like the bear had been chewing a stick of celery. To add insult to injury, the moose, of course, is now fair dinner for the bear. A shelf of ice, about 4 feet thick, stood on the edge of the pool, and the bear, with a tremendous lunge, got his hind feet up on the 4 foot ice shelf, and with his powerful front two legs, dead lifted the whole weight of the moose, which was probably in excess of 700 pounds. He lifted this moose up onto the ice cap and began having a moose lunch. At any rate, we landed in the area, which was legal at the time, and collected a big grizzly bear spring pelt. As we circled, I requested that the two cameramen be sure to get the light settings right, as the day was extremely bright and cloudless, and a lot of light, too much light for the cameras. So they agreed that their light settings were near perfect, and they went to great extremes, and they shot some of their movie and still film at one speed and then another speed with various shutter speed settings and light openings. Anyway, at some later date, I got word from one of the camera hunters that allowed that most of their film was overexposed. Otherwise, it would have been a world champion movie coverage of bear in hot pursuit, and with the end result of the bear literally eating about a third of the moose. On another occasion, a general from the Mexican army sent his son to Alaska in quest of a huge brown or grizzly bear. Now, the arrangement was that the general would pay for the son's hunt, providing the son was able to collect a bear skin that was larger than that of his father, which had been taken 20 years previous in Kodiak Island. This is some order, because the big bears are getting fewer and farther between, and they're difficult to hunt in the spring. The hunt proceeded, however, and within 4 days it appeared that the general's son would have a free trip, inasmuch as we thought his trophy would be larger than that of his father, the bear that the general had hunted on Kodiak Island 20 years previous. Sure enough, when the final figures were in and the bear was all safely made into a rug, the dimensions were slightly greater than the dimensions of the father's bear, and therefore the hunt was on the general. There's many of these hunting adventures take place when the lives of the hunters and the guides are somewhat jeopardized. In particular, mine was an old-time guide whose name was Pennington. Now, Pennington lived in Alaska for 40 years, and he was one of the great names in the guiding business. And he had two clients on a bear hunt in the early spring of the early 50s. At any rate, he stalked this particular bear, and unbeknown to him, the bear not only had a den, but had a moose kill very close to the den as the guide and his two hunters closed the distance on the bear. They surmised that the bear would be in his den, when actually the bear was 300 yards distant on the moose kill, fresh moose kill. So as the two hunters and the guide approached, they were literally bushwhacked by the bear, who outright killed the guide and badly maimed both hunters. And in Alaska, when there are many hunters and many bears, every season there's a tragedy takes place, the hunter versus the bear. Usually the bear comes out second best, but not always. Occasionally he takes a hunter with him. One of the favorite denning in locations for the big brown Kodiak type and the grizzly bears of this area is in the broken glacial ground in the foothills, some distance, 60 miles or so to the north of Talkeetna. There's a particular time, middle of April, when from there on till the first part of May, when all the bears come out of their dens and begin the new season. Now, they've hibernated, of course, in the den since October, November of the previous winter. And at that time they have hibernation, they go into the den and they weigh 50% more than their spring weight. They sleep throughout the raging blizzards of the winter and come out in the springtime gaunt and hungry. One particular location where you could often see five or six big dig outs on the side of this deep glacial moraine mountain type of location is north of Talkeetna, and it appears, of course, at this time of the dig out of the den, there's 15 or 20 feet of snow, and when the bears do dig out of the den, why, it looks like a huge bulldozer has worked its way out of the side of the mountain, and they leave a commanding set of tracks as they amble down the mountainside in search of their first food of the season. Bears will eat a number of things. In the fall, they seem to fatten up on a particular kind of willow root, the white willow root, they relish. Also, of course, they finish the salmon season, and they eat tremendous quantities of salmon just prior to their hibernation. They've also been known to eat each other in some cases. On one hunt of about 1952, we left three carcasses, and in this particular bear area, and I returned at a later date to recover the skulls of the bears, only to find that the other bears had dug up the remaining fragments of the September killed bears, and they had eaten even the skulls almost to the last bone fragment. The miners of the area in the Cache Creek and the Fairview placer gold mining country have their problems with the bears. If any food is left in a cache, It has to be an extremely solid structure or the bears will take it apart. In one case, an old-timer left some bacon in a cellar. The cellar was constructed of 12-inch square bridge timbers. On the return in the following spring, the miner was shocked to see that the bears had done a thorough job of removing the 12-by-12 timbers and had got into the supplies and scrambled all the non-perishable cornmeal, beans, and flour, including some of the pickled hams. And this is a minor disaster when this food is freighted into the mining area and is not there as expected when a miner goes in to begin his operation. I also had another trip with about a 50-pound pack, so I returned the 10-mile route and picked up the second load, pack sack load of personal gear. Once again, I returned over the 10-mile route to the Caterpillar train pickup location. And by the time I had made the return trip twice, it was about 2 in the morning, and the heavy rain, the thunderstorms prevailed. My friend Deese had recovered somewhat from his hospitalization back injury, and so plans proceeded for the next hour or two at an old cabin known as the Elwell location. And at about 9 o'clock this following morning, same day, the Caterpillar train made its appearance, and we journeyed on our way to Talkeetna to pick up a load of supplies. Also, our plan was to get completely outfitted for our cabin building trap line operation in the Rich Fur District of the Croteau River. Deese was an old trapper and an excellent woodsman, and there was promise to make a considerable amount of revenue from the fur in the area, as it had not been trapped for years. So the plans were changed slightly upon arrival at Talkeetna. About a day and a half later, we noticed tremendous activity. The old Civil Aeronautics Authority were in the process of building an airfield, a large airfield, right at Talkeetna, and all hands were urgently needed. And we were offered at least 2 months' work on this airfield project at a very substantial wage. At the mine, you recall, we worked for 50 cents an hour for 10 hours a day. As I recall, the CAA base wage was about $2.50 an hour. Naturally, we thought it was a great opportunity, so we elected the trap line could survive with double tents later in the winter, and we could put 2 months at $2.50 an hour in on the airfield before the freeze-up. So things went smoothly. Construction on the airfield proceeded. There were clearing crews, of which we were part, and survey crews were surveying out the various locations for the towers and the communication buildings and the quarter sites. So after about a month, that would put us into the first part of October, early snows begin to fall. And one day, the commissioner of Talkeetna, Ben Mayfield, was notified of a terrible disaster in the Cache Creek country. And it resolved that the Jenkins mine operation had been murdered to a man. That is, Mr. Jenkins, Mrs. Jenkins, and the hired hand had met an untimely fate at the mine, and it was a question for the FBI, a federal case, and also it involved Dick Francis, an old miner who lived over the hill several miles from the Rich Jenkins mine. There'd been considerable enmity on the part of Dick Francis, the old miner, and Jenkins, the gnome gold stampeder, and for years they had litigation and lawsuits and on infringement of who owned what part of which land of this particular area that was had proven to be a very rich placer source. It developed that also Dick Francis had been murdered. So this is a quadruple murder in an area of the Cache Creek gold mines. To this day, it's unsolved, but the indications are quite strongly that the French-Canadian Clark, who was also in this particular area, was implicated. As a matter of fact, he was the one that turned the discovery of the disaster into the authorities, to Mr. Ben Mayfield, Commissioner of Talkeetna. Immediately, a posse was formed at Talkeetna, and the commissioner, the FBI, and several deputies immediately departed for the area. And strangely enough, Mr. Clark was appointed the chief of the posse. The buildings, the evidence, and the bodies were partially destroyed as the search party lived in the cabins for about 10 days. One interesting sidelight was that the Jenkins and their hired hand, Joey Boutel, had been brutally clubbed. Not so with Dick Francis, the old miner several miles over the mountain. He had apparently been shot. Now, I just posed problem: had the old miner wiped out the Jenkins mine operation and then shot himself? And this theory was dissolved, however, when they discovered that the weapon, the supposed suicide weapon Dick Francis may have used to end his life, was a single action 44. On a single action pistol, you must cock the pistol and squeeze the trigger with each shot. It was then discovered that the old miner, Dick Francis, had two fatal bullet holes over the top of his right ear. Naturally, it would be impossible to shoot yourself twice in the head with a 44 caliber pistol in this manner. So the thing remains a mystery to this day, and never has been solved. It's still an open case in the annals of the FBI records. But another point was that they appointed an old timer who was to act as a caretaker at the mine. And when the posse left, the caretaker took over, and he used wood from the very generous wood pile. And finally, about the 15th of November, the old man listened to the moaning of the wind and watched the torrents of snowflakes cover the land, and he became increasingly uneasy. For one thing, he was running out of wood, and for another thing, it was tremendously spooky there as the wind screamed and howled through the rafters of the old mine cabin. Old-timer got edgier and edgier, and finally, when his coffee had run out and he was down to the last stick of wood, he resolved that he should mush out to Talkeetna on his snowshoes over the new 5-foot snowfall. So at this particular time, Deese and I had established one of several cabins in a Croteau River area, which was right on the trail to the Cache Creek mines. And late one night, in a miserable, owly storm, there was a knock on the door. We opened the door, and here stood the old caretaker, exhausted. And he carried with him an extremely heavy pack. And the cabin, this particular cabin, was quite small. And so Deese and I invited the old-timer in to have a bowl of stew and put him up for the night overhead in the loft. And the old-timer didn't have much to say. And he finished off 3 big bowls of stew, climbed up in the loft, and that was the last we heard of him. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard a slight movement overhead and thought nothing of it. Later on in the morning, about 7 o'clock, I looked out the cabin window, and there was a fading set of snowshoe trail leading away from the cabin and in the direction of Talkeetna. So we thought it strange that the old-timer would depart at 2 o'clock in the morning, but there was a good reason. He did arrive at Talkeetna, and he'd planned and tried to make a connection for a southbound passenger freight train. He narrowly missed the connection, and this would necessitate him staying in Talkeetna a whole week for the next train. He became involved in social round of drinks at one of the bars, and people naturally were interested in all the intrigues of being a caretaker at the mine where everyone had been murdered a month or so before. And as the night wore on and the old caretaker became more taken away with the spirits of the bar, he released some information. The information was that if he could have possibly caught a train, he would have absconded with all the gold cleanups. One of the things that hadn't been found at the mine was the 7 pokes of gold, which constituted the complete cleanups for the season of 39. After he had missed the train and had become involved with the social bartenders and the people at the bar, he decided that maybe he wouldn't run off with the seven folks of gold after all. Possibly he would just turn them into the commissioner. And this is the route that he finally went. And I was called in from the trap line to verify that the seven pokes of gold were the total amount of gold cleaned up for the summer of 39. As I say, the case of the Cache Creek murders is still unsolved, and it's an open case in the annals of the FBI to this day. I might say that after our two-month job with the old CAA on the airport at Talkeetna, Deese and I had gathered together our winter supplies and our cabin building equipment and had departed via the old Cache Creek Trail for the location near the Croteau River. And it was near a place called Gate Creek that we were caught midday one day in a tremendous blizzard, and we momentarily camped because of the heavy snowfall. We decided we may be 4 miles south of our planned cabin location, but since Gate Creek was a possibility for a good location, we decided that we would build a cabin at that location. So the cabin building proceeded. We built a 10 by 12 foot cabin and put a double 10 by 12 foot waterproof tent over the top of the frame of the cabin. And it was this location we were at when the old caretaker came through from the mine locations. Anyway, the blizzard roared and blew for 4 more days, and by that time we pretty well had the cabin up and secured. What we didn't realize was that in the tremendous blizzard we had misjudged our distance on the old trail, and unbeknown to me, since we were further along the trail than anticipated, we had built our new cabin not 300 yards from a cabin that had been established already for about 55 years. Now this cabin was directly behind us about 500 yards. And as I was cutting down a tree on the day of the breakaway of the storm, 4.5 days from the time we began the cabin building, I was amazed and appalled to see old Matt Hamburg's ancient trapline cabin scant 500 yards from our new cabin location. Naturally, if we'd realized we had been that far down the trail on the Cache Creek Road, we could have used the old tin roof cabin of Matty Hamburg and saved ourselves considerable amount of work, which we could invest in a cabin in another location. During the summer of 1963, there were approximately 8 expeditions in the area of McKinley. One was a guided expedition, about 16 members. There was another expedition of about 8 members, which was Hans Moser, professional skier attacking a new route from the northwest ridge of the North Peak of Mount McKinley. Now, this route had never been successfully accomplished, and it posed some tremendous problems. Hans Moser's expedition got off to a slow start. With permission to drop at the 8,000-foot level, an airdrop of about 700 pounds, I'd waited for weather. The weather for the proposed airdrop on the northwest ridge, the North Peak of McKinley, was extremely bad. Finally, 5 days after the proposed airdrop date, I was able to successfully drop the 700 pounds of supplies at the 8,500-foot level, northwest ridge, Wickersham Wall, McKinley. Hans Moser then continued the precarious first climb of the northwest ridge. They also ran into severe storms en route, and their objective was to climb the North Peak, then the South Peak of McKinley, the tall 20,320-foot peak, and then to descend via the West Buttress route and have a hopeful pickup on the 7,000-foot level Kehltna Glacier West Buttress approach. As I say, there were about seven or eight expeditions in the area at the same interval of time. One of the expeditions was about a 17-man guided expedition who were making their way up the west approach through the 11, 12, 14,000-foot levels en route to the west approach route of the South Peak of McKinley. So, on a break of the weather, I was checking the location of the various expeditions when I noticed an emergency call for help from the 12,500-foot level, just slightly below a place called Windy Corner. Now, they call this Windy Corner because of the tremendous jet force winds that scream and swoop around the high altitudes of McKinley. And it's common knowledge now that no one should ever camp on Windy Corner for fear of being blown bodily away, tent and all, over the south face of McKinley. The camp of the guided expedition, us calling for assistance, was slightly below Windy Corner, approximate 12,500-foot elevation. And they indicated they had an injured party member and he needed immediate pickup. So the winds and the visibility were very poor this particular day. So I came back early the next morning for the pickup. I used a 150-horsepower Super Cub. And I made a successful landing below Windy Corner, and I learned that Dr. Lathrop's son, who was another member of the guided expedition, had ice-axed his right boot and had probably frozen his right foot since the insulation of the boot was inundated with the rip by the ice axe, and he needed immediate evacuation. So it was some distance of about a quarter of a lateral mile to move Dr. Lathrop's son to the waiting Super Cub. I had inspected the packed down runway at the steep 12,500 foot level, and it seemed suitable for the takeoff with the passenger. Our high landing on that same route is at 14,300 feet. Snow conditions were almost ideal. There had been 3 feet of fresh snow on an old crust, but this had been fairly well packed down, and it looked like as soon as they could get the lad aboard, why, we'd be able to stage the takeoff, but this was not the case. We loaded the lad aboard, and at that almost precise moment, there's a tremendous wind from the east. Blew a gale, and it had mounting intensity in it till it sounded like 6 or 8 steam locomotives going overhead at the same time. A lenticular standing wave cloud suddenly appeared in all quadrants, and the only thing to do, since the takeoff would be downwind, was to tie the plane down. We did this in the manner of digging deep holes underneath the wing tie-down locations and burying snowshoes and attaching ropes to the snowshoes. And within an hour, heavy snow swirled around the windy corner, 12,500-foot area, and a wind of 70 miles an hour or greater in heavy, turbulent blasts scoured the mountain. So the night was spent checking the tie-downs of the plane. It snowed about a foot an hour, and then some of the snow was rapidly whipped off into the atmosphere over the side of the south face of McKinley. Some of it was whipped off to the north side over the Wickersham Wall, and it was a violent storm. Continued all night, and long about 3 next afternoon, there appeared breaks in the clouds, and we had an 8-foot snowfall, which practically covered the plane over. The breaks appeared, blue sky appeared, the wind shifted from a different direction, and suddenly it was calm, and by 4 o'clock afternoon, there was a tremendous heat of the mid-afternoon sun beating down on the west approach of McKinley. During this time, the powder snow turned to sticky cotton taffy-type snow, not conductive for a takeoff because it was just not sliding snow. Well, we beat a runway about 1,200 feet long, and it appeared to be adequate, and we went over and over this area, and the angle of the runway was 15, 18 degrees steep. Everything appeared in order. And we again loaded Dr. Lathrop's son aboard the aircraft and staged a takeoff down a narrow canyon heading westbound. As I came to the end of the 1,200-foot runway section down the steep west approach, I was able to get the plane into the air, and I continued down the canyon about a distance of 2 miles, and I was suddenly shocked to see that ahead of me and to the left and to the right was solid fog. We had been about 3,000 or 4,000 feet over this solid fog overcast that completely blocked the escape route down the west approach of McKinley. And the clouds billowed in front of me. There was no chance to outclimb the tremendous billowing clouds in the heat of the hot afternoon. So I made a blind landing down the steep west approach straight ahead. This was the only thing to do. Right turn or left turn was impossible. To outclimb it was impossible. The only way out was to land straight ahead. This was accomplished in in a very hairy manner. There are many crevasses, deep ice holes, big enough to throw hotels into. We missed the big ones, we slid over the small ones, and we got stopped. In the meanwhile, the 16 men remainder of the guided tour crew and Hans Moser expedition had noticed the aircraft disappear into the fog, and they were quite apprehensive. So they skied like the wind down through the fresh snow to our location, and were quite happy to see that we'd made a successful landing going down the glacier, downhill in a whiteout fog condition. I might say that three other takeoff attempts were necessary before I finally became airborne at about the 9,000 foot level, about 8 lateral miles down the west approach of McKinley. The snow became stickier, and the press of the emergency was great. Gangrene was setting in on the lad's feet. He needed antibiotics and special medical care. And so this prompted us to make 3 tries. Each time we got into deep, sticky snow, we overrun our takeoff area that we had mashed down with our snowshoes. Finally, in desperation, I unloaded everything, all the emergency gear of the aircraft, and